The new terrorists are neither sick nor desperados, but obviously radical religious in a demonic way. They feel as martyrs of their faith in paradise and much revered by their families and peer groups. Second, what kind of conviction motivates them? Since decades, the USA are presented by fanaticized masses in some Islamic countries. Remember the struggle between the Shah of Persia and Ayatollah Khomeini. They are presented in many countries as a great Satan. And behind this is the Western world as satanic, secular modernity, materialism, pornography, high divorce rate, drug dependency, and women's liberation. All this all belong to the satanic empire. The great Satan is nothing else than the apocalyptic enemy of God. Whoever weakens and humiliates this Satan is on God's side. Number three, the idea to fight in the final battle between God against God's satanic enemy takes away, obviously, any inhibition on killing of people, elevates the ecstasy of the arrogance of power, turns suicide into a divine service. These suicide terrorists must feel like God, who destroys the godless. They don't need any justification for their mass murder, and that is new, because they feel as divine executioners. The meaning of their terrorism is terror, nothing else. Now, this is not terrorism out of poverty and injustice. The terrorists came not from the slums of Africa, but from rich families and rich countries in the Near East. It is called in Germany, in one of our papers, terrorism deluxe. The motivation must lie in a special kind of Islamistic apocalypticism and in the ancient Islamic assassin tradition. Let me say at the end, no God can justify this suicide mass murder, and the terrorists will not end in paradise, but in hell. Now, the biblical apocalypses are not pessimistic at all. They are not pessimistic end-of-the-world scenarios which spread anxiety and terror around and aim to paralyze men and women. On the contrary, the biblical apocalyptic traditions keep alive hope for God's faithfulness to his creation in the terrors of time, who endures until the end will be saved. And when these things begin to take place, look up and raise your head, because your redemption is drawing near. Prophetic hope can be called hope in action. Apocalyptic hope is hope in danger. A hope that is capable of suffering, a patient and resolutely enduring hope. Whatever may come, at the end stands God. This is apocalyptic hope. It is a doctrine of hope and has nothing to do with these terrifying fantasies of world annihilation put forward by modern terrorists. Now, my last point, at the end, God's new creation. According to biblical traditions, world history does not begin with a fall of sin, so it does not end with the downfall of the world either. World history begins with a primordial blessing of the temporal creation, and it ends with the blessedness of the creation which will be eternal. God's last word is not a pronouncement of judgment, it is a word of creation. Behold, I make all things new. That is a new heaven and a new earth for which the first heaven and the first earth are to pass away, if we read the Revelation chapter 21. Everything we may imagine as a last judgment or the end of the world is provisional in relation to the finality of the new creation. How ought we to think about this promised new creation? It is not a matter of another creation which will take the place of the world we know. It is this creation we know which will be changed radically different. The book of Revelation does not say, "Behold, I create something new," but "Behold, I make all things that are created new." Now, what will be different? What will be new? First of all, the relationship to God will be different. The Creator who has created His work will come to His dwelling place in His creation and to His rest. His indwelling, in the Hebrew tradition, the Shekinah, will enter heaven and earth and make both worlds, the visible and the invisible world, new, that is, make them God's cosmic temple. God's glory will then dwell in all things and will illuminate and transfigure all created being on earth as it is in heaven. Now, this idea of the cosmic indwelling of God leads on to the idea of the transformation of temporal and mortal creatures into a creation that will be eternal and immortal world without end. What participates in God's glory will be eternal and immortal like God Himself. What will be annihilated is not creation itself, but only its sinful, temporal, and mortal form. So in a transformation, the old form will disappear and a new form will come. So created beings will be transfigured or transformed, or as the Orthodox theology says, deified, for then finite beings will participate in the infinite being of the indwelling and present God. The great end-time transformation process is a transition from contradictions to correspondence, from mortality to the immortality of the life of the world to come. Okay, but because God's righteousness and justice is the foundation for the eternal world, it must first be made to prevail in all things in the final judgment. The murderers must not prevail over their victims. There is justice in the world and hereafter, and there is the Holy One who guarantees justice for victims and for murderers. That is why in the Christian expectation, the new creation is preceded by the last judgment. But this divine righteousness and justice is not, as some may think, a retributive, punitive justice, revenge. I think it is the justice for which both the victims and the evil doers of human history creates justice and justifies. Or to put it another way, God comes not to cut down, He comes to raise up and bring things to right. This is His creative righteousness, and this will be executed on victims first and on the evildoers or the murderers on the other side. And it is in this sense that we then can say at the end, God will be all in all. Now, two personal consequences. I return again to our situation after September 11. What happened on September 11 this year in New York has indeed changed the situation of humankind, not only in America, but everywhere. Suicide, mass murder has deeply hurt the life of peaceful people in New York and everywhere. Everybody's life is threatened. Nothing is secure anymore. World politics interferes with personal life, and there is no private life which is not related to world politics. This situation reminds me of the early years of my own generation in Germany. World War II destroyed our dreams of our personal future. No retreat into private happiness was possible. The political became the personal, and the personal the political. Many German families had thought religion as a private matter and had felt no religious obligation to resist when Jews were persecuted and murdered. We who survived had learned the lesson: retreat into privacy can lead to abundant misery. Now the generations born after the war, brought up in 50 years of peace, could concentrate on their personal careers and private happiness. Politics could be neglected by many of them. Some called the 80s and the 90s, therefore, the me decade, and analyzed in the Western culture a culture of narcissism in the affluent classes, at least of the Western world. In Germany, people talked recently about a Spaßgesellschaft, a fun society, because one could hear young people saying, I don't care about anything, I want to have my fun and please myself, and that's the meaning of my life. I want to have fun. All of this had found a brutal end. There is no personal life without political danger, and therefore no meaning of personal life without political engagement in the necessary resistance against terror and death, and the no less necessary work for justice worldwide. And the second point, I wrote down to myself, Christian hope is, I said at the beginning, is resurrection belief. Not optimistic belief in a progress to a beautiful goal of history, and not apocalyptic nihilism. To believe in the resurrection does not only mean to believe in Christ's resurrection on Easter, and a universal resurrection of the dead on the last day. This belief gives us already here and now the courage to begin here and now something new. In my end is my beginning. We learn to stand up and to start anew after failure. To fall down is no problem. All what matters is to stand up and start a new begin. I think we all understand this. But what is much more difficult is to stand up and start a new thing after success. The development of the Western and the modern world is a success story, yes, of the scientific technological mind. Its globalization after 1989 and to the one world was very successful for us, but unfortunately not for everybody. The ghastly ditch between the First and the Third World was deepened. Millions of homeless migrants are wandering around on the globe, knocking on the door of rich countries. The mortality of children in Africa is growing. The losers of the globalization of our world are pressing for their right to live and to freedom. So we must start a new globalization, a global action against poverty, a global liberation from hunger and homelessness, and a global respect for cultural identity. Globalization for tomorrow means for me first the renunciation of the arrogance of power, we can do without this infantile pride, and second solidarity and compassion with the wounded and suffering people on earth. And this is perhaps the most important thing, to feel a solidarity and compassion with the wounded and the suffering people on earth. Out of this, we may again start a new globalization, a globalization of righteousness and of peace, and we have to take away our American or European lifestyle, which we wanted to globalize. We don't need to globalize that. It's sometimes boring to see everywhere the same. We need a variety of cultures, and therefore we need respect for other cultures in a united world. And united we must become. Perhaps with the old saying of George Washington, united we stand, divided we fall. Thank you.
This afternoon at 1:30 we have a full discussion time, but I think we have just a moment for perhaps one, perhaps two questions before we break from this session. There are microphones roving around, and if you would like to ask a quick question, then please indicate.
This is a question for Dr. Moltmann. Two issues that we face specifically, perhaps not uniquely, in the United States are both a Darbyism, an interpretation, very modern interpretation of apocalypticism, connecting biblical imagery with political events, social events, you know, literal events within history, that is very much a part of the popular theology of evangelical Christianity, which, and it seems to me, to be very much in opposition with both the historical Orthodox Christianity and your understanding of apocalypticism. Is it imperative, is it, I guess, worth our time to actively battle, actively speak against, teach against, work against that kind, that understanding of apocalypticism that is so popular in the United States?
Well, I'm not familiar with all types of apocalypticism in the United States, but my feeling is Christianize this type of apocalypticism. Bring them back to the cross and the resurrection of Christ. And bring them back from speculations. The only book I read about, from this type of apocalyptic interpretation of world history was Hal Lindsey's late Great Planet Earth. If I look back to this, it was all wrong. He had beautiful ideas how this red army of the Soviet Union will come to the Valley of Armageddon, but since more than 12 years there is no red army anymore, so what was the meaning of it? I think these are more or less biblical speculations, and this has an old tradition, of course. But this is, ask yourself, okay, this may be apocalyptic, but is it Christian? This is the main question. And then bring them back to Christ and see what they would say about the world in the view of the crucified one, how the crucified one would see the world in which we live, and the resurrected one, how he would see the world in which we live. And a very simple, wise statement was the one which Niemöller got from a very simple man who had a poster on his working table. What would Jesus say to this? If you ask that question, then you find the right answer, I believe.
Dr. Moltmann, do you think it would tend to defuse the terrorists if America would tone down its support of Israel and perhaps even remove its troops from Saudi Arabia?
Well, Dr. Greider, you put your finger on the one of the wounds. America and the European community must do everything they can to bring peace to the Near East. And this is a balance between Israel and the Palestinians. The one-sided support of Israel would create more and more of this type of suicide terrorists because they were created in the depressed areas of the Palestinians. The Palestinians got the promise from George Bush, the father, to get a state of their own. They didn't get it. Now we have a similar promise again. Now realize that promise. Have a Palestinian state next to the state of Israel, and then support both of them so that they form peace on the basis of human rights for Palestinians and Israelis. And this is a very urgent task, which must never be forgotten if the terrorists may disappear one day. But this is a task which is necessary. And the second, with regard to Saudi Arabia, I think it was President Jimmy Carter who bound American foreign policy to the improvement of human rights. And this was very important for the Latin American countries suffering under military dictatorships in Argentina, for example. Now, what is the situation of human rights in Saudi Arabia? Yeah, I think the situation is worse than everywhere else. And you cannot protect the royal family over against their own people. This is not according to the promise of your constitution that all people are created free and equal, even the people of Saudi Arabia. And this is what many peaceful Muslims are saying to us. Why don't you improve human rights in the Near East? Why do you support dictatorships and this type of royal family? Or in Kuwait, it's not very different. So to improve human rights with all the means you have and can, I think this would be one solution or one step to bring righteousness into the world and work for a united world. Otherwise, if we only protect our own interest, the European interest or the American interest, we will create hatred.
We shall have to make that the last question, I think, but we are resuming our discussion at 1:30. Now, the Dean, Dr. Robinson, wished to make an announcement.
A few announcements, reference to the remainder of today and then in the morning, and also for those of you who are interested in continuing education units. In the table in the back, and also I think in the balcony, there are green flyers like this that if you desire for yourself, and it would help you in terms of your organization to have continuing education unit credit for the experience last night, today, and tomorrow morning, then simply fill this out and leave that with us or mail this to us. There is a slight administrative fee for that, but we would be happy to facilitate that for you and then to mail a certificate to you. So please be aware of that. For those of you who may be registered for the NTS Alumni Day, continuing education unit fee is already covered in your registration, so you want to fill that out before you leave these days. We will convene again this afternoon at 1:30 here in the Chapman Chapel, and there will be a panel discussion with three of the faculty members from NTS, plus Dr. Moltmann, and we will be dealing with the issues that have been raised both last night and today, and then perhaps in some of Dr. Moltmann's writings as well. And so you're all invited to return to that. We will convene at 1:30 here and look for an adjournment at about 3 o'clock. Then the final lecture for the series will happen tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock again here in the Chapman Chapel, and you're all invited to return to all of those occasions. There are two planned luncheon events. One is for the Alumni Day. For those of you who are registered for that, we will have a luncheon in the main lounge of the seminary. And for the students here at Nazarene Theological Seminary, and I'm sure they would be willing to invite any who would like to join them, there will be a brown bag kind of discussion group luncheon that will happen upstairs in room 304. So if you brought your lunch with you or you need to go over to the commons and get something or do your usual thing with the vending machines downstairs, Those luncheons will convene at 11:30, and so those two groups particularly, and for those of you who are guests today, there's a very fine eating facility immediately to the north of the seminary called Nazarene Commons with very good and reasonably priced food for you, or along TrueStar, several fast food places, or in a wonderful neighborhood called Brookside, which is just about a mile west on 63rd Street. There are also some very nice eating establishments there that we would invite you to try. So thank you for your attendance both this morning and through these days, and have a wonderful time of discussion over lunch, and we will see you at 1:30.